I am Planta on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Rafe Mayer died this past Monday, the 9th of October 2017. He was 85. Rafe was a great friend of the show, appearing 11 times over the last 14 years.
Good Lord, don't tell me you survived 11 of me, Joe.
They're great, great chats over the years. And it
has been fun.
It has. He was one of the early guests when I started this program in 2004, and he has appeared the most over the last 1,500-plus programs. If you haven't seen or heard the scores of news stories, tributes, and posts online about Rafe, I'd suggest you start with a beautiful obituary written by the magnificent writer Tom Hawthorne that appeared on the TAI site. There you'll also read a fine remembrance from David Beers, who writes of Rafe's conscience. Jim Goddard's show featured Rafe regularly, even up to this past spring after the provincial election. Damien Gillis, Rafe's friend and collaborator, has posted a tremendous piece over at the Common Sense Canadian, remembering his compatriot in the many advocacies they shared over the last decade or so. This program now will feature clips of Rafe's appearances over the years. Joining me as well will be Sherelle Tobin, Rafe's trusted friend and former producer at CKNW for many years, especially in the years where I was a devotee of their broadcasts. Ms. Tobin is now the Director of Journalism and Programming for CBC British Columbia, a position she took up recently, one that she told Rafe about shortly before his death. George Garrett will also join me to discuss what it was like working with Rafe at CKNW, where George was this town's intrepid reporter, a title that Rafe gave him. I will miss Rafe very much. He was someone I knew for nearly 20 years. I was still in high school when we began exchanging emails. He was always quick with a reply, a suggestion for something to read or some article to look up about our shared interests. Politics, always politics, Winston Churchill, books, and jazz. I was a Sinatra fan and he wasn't. He didn't think Sinatra was a good guy because he was such a bully, but we agreed on Ella Fitzgerald. His generosity with his time early on, and especially when I'd invite him on this show to be a guest, I shall never forget. I appreciated it, and I can only hope he knew I did. If I didn't tell him enough, I hope you'll know just what he meant to me. In the days since his death, though, I am not as sad as one might be for losing a friend, but actually heartened that so many others got to know Rafe as I did. He was a mentor to so many people, as you'll hear Sherelle attest. He managed to endear himself to a lot of people with the little bits of encouragement he spread over the years. He did have his flaws. Who amongst us doesn't? As he says in a clip you'll hear upcoming, he realizes them but did not dwell upon them. He was far from perfect, but that's part of the impact he had on his colleagues, his friends, his listeners, this province, and this country. Nobody was ambivalent about Rafe, and I think deep down he liked that. You will hear throughout this show a more reflective Rafe, at times a more melancholy Mayer. We talked about death, the subject of a later book he wrote, The Homestretch. Rafe Mayer was a giant in a province that it seems doesn't have them anymore. His opinions didn't change as much as they evolved, and that's the eternal lesson that a lot of us take away from Rafe's life. He never stopped learning and thinking about history, the future, and the world around him. If we can only live as fully as he seemed to, we might not do so badly. I think a lot of people that knew Rafe Mayer, both afar and up close, will look at the score of his life, the good and decent, the faults and frailties throughout, and say he did not do too badly. Rafe, a lot of the people in this province and beyond have been thinking of you and pulling for you the last year or so, and I hope you know that a lot of people love you out there.
Well, thank you very much, Joe. That's awfully nice to know. You know, when you spend a lot of your life saying things to people that they don't want to hear and making enemies and making lots of mistakes. You know, I don't have the habit of looking back too much on the mistakes I made. I'm glad I don't. But it's nice to know. I do get a feeling that even though I'm getting on a bit now, and the people that I was dealing with in the years gone by, they're all getting on a little bit now too, and that young people are a different group. But you know, every once in a while, one of my grandkids comes to me and says, "You know, Grandpa, we were talking about the other day in school," or whatever it is, and that's kind of nice.
That was from the end of an appearance in 2014. 10 years earlier, in 2004, Rafe was on radio station 600 AM after being fired from CKNW. He was joined by Sherelle Tobin, a former producer, who stayed with Rafe until he signed off in a year or so later. Beyond their work as broadcasters, Sherrell was a loyal friend to Rafe. Here from 2004, Rafe speaks about Sherrell's influence on his work, as well as the evolution of his thinking.
You know, Sherrell has been an influence for the better on my broadcasting for a long time. But I think I've got to take the blame or whatever it is for the way I think myself. I don't think I can pass that on to anybody else. When I was in government, a lot of my colleagues called me Red Rafe because I kept bringing in that consumer legislation. You've got to remember, I brought in a Motor Dealers Licensing Act in a caucus with six car dealers. And I was the person that negotiated the saving of the Skagit River against the wishes of my caucus that wanted to turn into a big lake full of jet skiers. So, you know, I think I've always felt that way, but what really has changed me more than anything else in the last couple of years is, first of all, I've seen what globalization has done to a lot of people. I've seen what NAFTA's done to a lot of people. I think those people should be helped. But secondly, I recognize that you can't change globalization. You're not going to change the trade agreements. They're there. There's no sense standing up and screaming that they've got to go because they're not going to. So I have become, I guess, what I call a 21st century socialist in the sense that I recognize these problems. I recognize the dictatorship of a corporation in our society, and I want to recognize it but do something about it, try to make it better. That's a lot different, I think, than trying to abolish things that are unabolishable.
Sherrell Tobin is now the Director of Journalism and Programming at CBC British Columbia. We spoke this past Monday, mere hours after Rafe's death was announced. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, Sherrell Tobin. Ms. Tobin, good morning.
Good morning.
I'm glad to talk to you, but saddened by the circumstances. When did you first work with Rafe?
I first started working with Rafe around 1996 that I started working at CKNW, but it was around 1997 sometime when I started working on his show with his then-producer Carolyn Haar and myself, and that was when Patty, his ex-wife, had just stopped working on the show as a producer, so I moved into her spot. And actually, I didn't know who Rafe was when I first started. I was about a year and a half out of journalism school and had one job in Williams Lake, and then I found myself at CKNW, where I was working as an overnight operator and an operator on the board. And then I made my way over doing some fill-in producing, and then next thing I knew, I was working on Rafe's show. So, of course, I learned a lot about him quickly, and he's been a huge character in my life.
Yeah, he gave you away at your wedding, if I recall.
Yes, well, my husband and I actually walked down the aisle together, but Rafe was at my wedding, and he gave the toast to the bride at my wedding, which I'll never forget. It was actually just my 15th anniversary the other day, and I was just remembering that. Rafe pulled me aside about a year and a half into working with him and took me out to lunch one day and asked me if he could be my mentor because he felt that I had a career ahead of me and he wanted to be a small part of it. And I thought, oh, who gets that to happen to them these days? And I felt like it was a blessing then. And certainly we had our differences of opinion here and there, but we always had such healthy discussion and debate. And he taught me so much about being a great broadcaster and about trusting your gut in this business and being true to what you believe, and it was literally cherished the time we worked together. You get spoiled at the beginning of your working life to be able to work with Rafe Mara, that's for sure.
Great lessons from him, not only for broadcasting, but for life in general.
So many.
Yeah.
Many of them have been through being with him and watching him go through things. Everybody had an opinion about Rafe Mara when I started on that show, and I mentioned I didn't know him then. And, it was one of those times, well, I'm just going to judge this character for myself. And, you can't put him in a box like, oh, he was right-wing, he was this or that, like people thought they could back then. And seeing him have such strong opinions and yet change those opinions with more information over time was certainly a lesson in life and in learning. But also the lesson to trust your gut and listen and dig and dig and dig even deeper to know what's right. As a journalist, to hold on to a story and to not think, as many, bosses might say to you, oh, people are tired of that topic. Oh, you're talking about that again. And Rafe knew that if you grabbed it and you dug it and you held on with it and you went on, you bring your audience with you. And the number one thing as a broadcaster is, to never talk down to your audience or assume they can't understand something complicated. All the good stories are in the complicated, and Rafe never underestimated the intelligence of his audience and their ability to understand, you know, complex constitutional issues or the law or electoral reform or the science of salmon or whatever the case may be. And certainly that would be one. And also anybody can ask a hard question, but the real work is in the follow-up.
Yeah, indeed. He, you mentioned three things just a moment ago. The Constitution, terribly influential during Charlottetown.
Mm-hmm.
The electoral reform, he talked about that day after day. And then, you know, when Campbell gets in 2001, they have the commission, largely from that report that Rafe and Gordon Gibson and a couple of others put together in their spare time, right?
Mm-hmm. I remember when they all gathered in a boardroom at CKNW meeting on the 20th floor for the first time, a bunch of constitutional guys and Rafe coming up with this idea for a citizens' assembly on electoral reform. And not very many people know that it connects back to Rafe as a suggestion to the then BC Liberal government. The unfortunate part was the supermajority that was required because it did get over 50%. And look at us again having that conversation in British Columbia with just the NDP government announcing last week that they're going to look at electoral reform again. A few of us in the office thought, well, we've already looked at it a lot. Are we going to choose the STV or is it just someone else's electoral reform? So he certainly had a sense of what the public was interested in and could care about.
And then fish farms. I mean, he talked about that day after day, and I'm sure it upset management and politicians alike. But, I mean, you can't go to a restaurant today without checking the menu or the menu itself saying that this is wild salmon or not, right?
Certainly. And, you know, as Rafe pursued that topic, I wasn't even there for the whole time he did it. He did it for years after I was gone from his show and over at the CBC as well. But it was sometime during that whole debate where he realized and the public realized that the politicians weren't going to do anything about it. So why don't we start exercising your right as a consumer and ask? And it would be people asking in the restaurants and asking at the shops. And then, of course, organizations like Oceanwise came up and started championing the cause as well. But I remember Rafe he used to love Earl's Restaurant, and they served wild salmon, and he loved it, and he loved the people that worked there. And then ultimately he stopped going there because they wouldn't stop serving farmed salmon. So he really tried to live the things that he spoke about on his show, even when it, you know, caused him some relationships along the way.
And there were so many elements of the show, and you mentioned that you started at NW in 96, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so when you worked with Rafe the years that you did, you mentioned you left for the CBC for a spell, and then you went back with him again, I guess, at 600, is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I did. Well, you know, it was an unfortunate circumstance when Rafe left CKNW, and I just couldn't see that being the end of how his story went. And so I did leave the CBC and go with him to Pattison Group there at AM 600. And that was an experience, starting up a talk show at an old East station. And, you know, it was a wonderful experience, though, for both of us. Everybody at that station was very kind to us. And, of course, you can't have the same ratings necessarily with that format. But that I remember that first book, that first ratings book, he took half of the audience with him. And it was a big deal because Jack FM became number one.
Mm-hmm.
But the unknown factor when people were talking about the ratings was that this big switch over on the AM dial, a bunch of the audience had followed Rafe for those 2 hours in the morning on 600 AM too. He had such a loyal audience. And I think it's because he respected them and he respected his position. And he has an authenticity that was just undeniable. It was riveting to listen to. Even those who didn't agree with him politically, you know, they tuned in.
Yeah, and people that would be afraid to go on the show knew what he was saying about them. And,
mm-hmm.
I mean, it was just riveting stuff. It was, as a broadcaster, it was marvelous. But he always worried, I guess, that because he hadn't had a career in journalism like Webster or Pat Burns, that was there a bit of, like, I guess, worry on his part as for his work?
Never for his work or what he was doing was right. He had a good instinct, and he always said, trust your tummy. In fact, he wrote that to me in an advice letter when I got a recent job, always trust your tummy. But he certainly felt on the outside of others compared to other journalists. He felt not accepted by other journalists, and I think it's something that bothered him a bit. I think it bothered him a bit. And I remember we did a show from the BC legislature and how surprised he was when Vaughn Palmer and all these esteemed writers from the press gallery came and watched the show and talked to him, and he was just so surprised because he just never felt accepted by them, and it really did mean a lot, those who did. But he would have his battles with different writers over issues, and he would go to the mat for his province or his issues, and it did lead to, you know, some friendships fraying over the years. And certainly the way that it went for him at CKNW was a wound he felt for years. He felt very hurt by how that went. But there were also some wonderful friends in journalism and broadcasting who were loyal and so engaging with Rafe, who he admired as well, just so many. And it's really nice hearing from those people and seeing their comments on a day like today.
Yeah. So he was the guy that he was on the air. There was no pretense or anything like that, right?
No, and he certainly didn't, you know, let me beat up this politician because I'm holier than thou or yeah. I'm perfect. Actually, it's a great lesson in life, too, is Rafe would lay out his flaws like a blanket at your feet and lay them all out before you, so maybe before you could say them.
Yeah.
But he was well aware of his own flaws. And he didn't try to be a perfect person, but I got to tell you, Joe, he did a lot for me personally, just in my confidence, having someone as a mentor like that and a champion. I mean, it was almost embarrassing how much he would try to help me and champion me as a broadcaster. But the other people, like, he did that for countless journalists, countless women on the air as well. He really was a feminist. As much as he was old school. So you could, you know, there's salty language from time to time and that kind
yeah.
of thing. But he was a true, authentic person. He cared a lot about BC and a lot about the people he loved, his family and his colleagues. Yeah.
Did he make a Churchillian out of you?
A Churchillian. In fact, the first book that Rafe gave me was Man of the Century, the Churchill biography.
Yeah.
And, yeah, how could he not, right?
Yeah.
I mean, talk about an amazing life. And Churchill was definitely his hero, along with Tiger Woods, who he stands by in spite of all the recent years, and, of course, such a huge baseball fan, and in addition to golf and fly fishing. He gave me my first fly fishing rod, too, and he got Kathy Ruddick, the champion fly
oh, yeah.
fisher, who
yeah.
used to be on the show. She gave me my fly fishing lessons, and he eventually stopped fly fishing, but I've considered that a gift he gave me as well. So many, really.
Yeah, you know, I think about that because he I think that was in one of his books or in one of the conversations I had with him in later years that he stopped doing that because he realized, you know, that it was hurting the fish.
I know. It kind of ruined it for me, too.
Yeah.
He was catch and release all the time, but then even catching them, he started to feel bad about, and so we stopped doing it. I'm sure his knees giving him trouble walking the banks of the river may have contributed to that as well, but he used to do a whole lot of fishing in Scotland and in our beautiful rivers in British Columbia as well, and really that's where he found the common ground with, you know, fishermen and the environment, and, you know, people would think, like, well, what do fishermen want to save fish for? You know, they want to catch them all.
Yeah.
But he would find these allies in these big causes, whether it be Kamano or gravel mine or that kind of thing, and thread that environment, that, you know, soul of our province through the environment. And his environmentalism really started with the fishing in a lot of regards, I think. And then, of course, we all know he went on to make it a huger part of his life and focus.
I was going to ask you about his legacy, but I mean, talking to you these last few minutes, I mean, it's clear that it's in you and the work that you do and a lot of your colleagues where you work today at the CBC.
I think, yeah, I think Rafe would say it was in his grandchildren. He loved his grandchildren, his great-grandchildren, and was so proud of them and wanted the world and British Columbia to be a great place always and preserved in the future. And I sure hope it's in democracy and engagement. I mean, there's nothing like the political engagement we have in British Columbia. I think people are still really engaged in politics. You know, you'll have market researchers tell you, too much politics, the audience doesn't want it. But really, British Columbians are engaged, and I think Rafe Mayer was one of those characters that helped that happen through his true authenticity, and I hope that's his legacy, true engagement locally, internationally, but especially locally and in this province. I hope that's his legacy. Free speech.
You're kind to do this, and when I heard the news Monday morning, I thought of Wendy and the family, naturally, and then I thought of you because I know how much he meant to you. But in conversations I've had with him and in writing that I've seen, of his, how much you meant to him, and how much you started there in 96. Those were the years that I started listening to him, and some of the best radio I've ever heard in this town, certainly, and it's his, and it's yours as well.
Well, thank you so much for saying that. It's such a privilege for me to have been part of it. I feel like I had this little window into history, and yet also met a kindred spirit in Rafe along the way, and we're really different people, but I try to do that kind of work every day, and I know a lot of journalists do, and I feel Rafe with me every day at work at the CBC. I think the old CBC people would be like, really? those who were around in the Soak Red years and in Rafe's early radio days, but yes, really, that trust your gut. And I'll never stop doing that, and I'll never stop being grateful for the memories, the hilarious and many wonderful memories.
Thanks for this, Sherelle.
Thank you, Joe. Have a great day.
That's the CBC's Sherelle Tobin. At his height, Rafe Mayer's broadcasting influenced environmental policy. He held politicians to account. He was known as Dr. No for his opposition to the Charlottetown Accord in 1992. Here from 2015, Rafe reflects on the various elements of his radio program. This builds into a discussion about Rafe's feelings about fly fishing. He and his wife, Wendy, were great fishermen, and in recent years, Rafe had to give that up. By the way, Rafe, what was the name of the woman that would come on your show once a week and give the fishing report?
Oh, Kathy Ruddick.
Yeah.
Oh, that's an astonishing story, really, you know, because I had more people would write me and phone me and say, you know, Rafe, I don't fish. I hate fishing.
Yeah.
I have no interest in fishing.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't miss Kathy Ruddick on Friday for all the money in the world. She was just one of those people that she's a lovely person, a dear friend of mine. She lives in Kamloops now, but she just had the knack, and boy, people loved her.
Yeah, and you learned about the province and the places, didn't you?
Absolutely, absolutely. And it was interesting because, you know, the management was probably less than enthusiastic about the idea in the first place.
Yeah.
And I had, I can't remember which one it was. I think it was Doug Rutherford, the program director, who wrote me a note, and he said, essentially, I said to him, but oh, he said, I hate fishing. I have absolutely no interest in fly fishing, but I wouldn't miss that segment for all the money in the world, you know.
Yeah.
So that's the way it was. Another one that was very much like it was the English professor from Simon Fraser.
Oh, yeah.
On Shakespeare.
Paul Boudreau.
Paul Boudreau.
Yeah.
And, you know, when we put him on, the manager said, do you really think anybody's interested in Shakespeare? And I think, Joe, I can say I used to have kind of a hunch about those things.
Yeah.
And I remember saying with Doug again, well, you know, Doug, I do, and I don't know much about it, but I remember back in school, and I remember how much I wished I knew more about it, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I think maybe people do. Well, boy, did they ever love it, you know.
Yeah.
And he was very, very popular, along with Christopher Gaze from
right.
Bart on the Beach. So I think what I tried to do in radio, and to some extent it succeeded, is do things that were different.
Right. And so I brought up Kathy Ruddick because there's a beautiful essay in the book about your love of fly fishing and how that came to an end.
Yeah, well, it's a strange story. I guess now I really don't know. I'd like to fish again, Joe, but I'm just physically not able to. So it's very easy for me now to take that position. But it was a kind of a metamorphosis. And what happened, really, I suppose everybody that fishes sooner or later gets a little upset about killing fish. And I'm no less than anybody else, but I would do it. And then when catch and release became the vogue, I thought, I'm saved. All I have to do now is release. And great fishermen like the various writers that I used to read would all say that's what you do, and if you do that, everything's fine. And then I still wondered a little bit, but then I convinced myself that it didn't hurt them. They didn't seem to like it very much, but I sure didn't hurt them. And I read an article by a man in Great Britain that I admired very, very much. And he wrote one of the fly fishing magazines, and his thesis was, if you go fishing, kill what you want to eat and then stop.
Yeah.
If you catch and release, you're torturing animals. And I thought to myself, oh, that's a bunch of crap. And then it started to eat at me. And I used to fish New Zealand every year. Mm-hmm. And I went down, I think, about 30 years in a row. And I fished one particular river, particularly, and I was on my favorite pool on my favorite river. And I was landing a fish, a nice probably 5-pound hen rainbow, and three or four other fish came up alongside her as I was netting her. And I thought to myself, God, don't tell me they bloody won't care. I can't believe that. But it really struck me. And in the meantime, Wendy, who is also a hell of a good fisherman, she started to get bothered with hooking small fish, and so we decided that, well, we're going to pack it in. Now, you've got to understand, we had thousands of dollars of equipment piled up over the years.
Yeah.
Well, we went out to a place that we used to go to dinner and had a couple of beer, and common sense took over. We said, oh, hell, we're not going to quit fishing. No, 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 no. Well, we went fishing the next day. We weren't very comfortable. Then we went up to a favorite place for dinner up in Maunganui in the north part of New Zealand to a fishing game club. And as we're having a beer out in the porch, one of the boats brought in three big fish, two very big marlin and one shark, and hung them up. And there was the blood streaming down the sides of these fish. They'd all be, I suppose, 150, 200 pounds, maybe more. And I said to Wendy, why? Why would you kill them? I mean, why would you molest them? You know, it just suddenly happened. That was it. I just couldn't fish anymore. And I came back and I called up my friends at the Georgia Strait Alliance and I said, would you like a whole bunch of fly tying stuff? I've got scads of it. And they very kindly said yes. And I'm sure now they really meant no. What the hell are we going to do with it? Well, they got it. They inherited bales of flies and hooks and got those one off. Got rid of all of that. I still got all the rods and reels, which are, I guess I'm waiting for a grandson or somebody or a granddaughter to come along and want to fish. But that was it, and I haven't fished since, and I miss it. I miss it very badly. I loved it.
Yeah, and it's a beautiful, it's one of those things in the book, like your essay on all the dogs you've owned. That just make, when you read the book, just, you know, wet your eyes a little bit.
Well, I guess I'm kind of a sentimental person, I guess, in lots of ways, Joe, and maybe that's one of the things I admired about Churchill. He wasn't afraid to cry.
Yeah.
And I'm afraid I'm that way myself. A lot of people don't know me that well and don't think that's true, but it is. I cry very, very easily. And when I think about the dogs I've had and some of the things I've done, and when I think of the way that I met Wendy, my wife, that sort of thing, I get very, very sentimental. And certainly dogs did it to me. I don't have one now because I'm just not able to handle it. But I look up at the wall right now, I see four paintings of my dog, Chauncey. Then there's another one over on the wall, another painting of him. Then I've got a calendar of Chocolate Lab puppy. So, you know, I still have that strong feeling, but I just... I have a neighbor in our complex, our condos,
yeah,
that walks dogs, and she brings them over to see me all the time. So that keeps me going.
Yeah, yeah, it's a beautiful essay, and I'm not someone who's ever owned a dog, but I mean I understood sort of the feelings that you obviously have for these animals that you've owned over the years.
Well, I think people might get a kick out of the essay I wrote about when Wendy went away and left me with Chauncey, our big chocolate Labrador, and how he would talk to me and make me do things, and it was a lot of fun. But everywhere, no, I love dogs, and it's. It was part of the fun of writing it.
Yeah, there's some great essays in there about when she would go off to, I guess, visit her granddaughter.
Yeah,
and
that's where she is now.
Yeah,
that.
And you're batching it, I guess, right?
Yeah, I'm batching it. And but I think it sort of starts out in the morning. I always thought that I did about 50% of the work with Chauncey. Well, I soon found out that wasn't so. And I think it was the first morning I came down, I was making breakfast, and he's down there, and he's nudging me. And I'm looking at him, what the hell do you want, Chauncey? Oh, yes, of course, you get that cookie. And so I gave him this great big cookie and go over and sit down with my cereal, my coffee to get started. He comes over and he sits down, tilts his head, and just stares at me. And I thought, Chauncey, what is it now? Oh, yeah, it's got to be your collar. It's got to go on. So this goes on, you know, all day long. And by the time I'm finished the day, I'm absolutely exhausted with all the things that he's doing. So it was good fun. And And as I say, I badly miss that.
Ralph Mayer did not make many friends amongst his colleagues when he'd rail about the lack of accountability and scrutiny politicians and leaders in the community were getting from the press.
That there hasn't been a sort of broadcaster in your mold who's held sort of authority to account in recent years.
No, there really hasn't been, Joe, and the loser is the public. The loser was never me. I had a great career. I enjoyed every minute of it, and had a lot of fun, and made pretty good money at it, did what I wanted to do. So Ralph Mayer is perfectly satisfied with how everything turned out. But the public has had just an absolutely appalling representation by that side of the media to which we've become so accustomed in British Columbia. Going back to the days of Pat Burns and Jack Webster and so on, we've become accustomed to people really holding authorities' feet to the fire. Not just government, but business and unions and so on and so forth. And that was all gone. Bill Good is a fine man. I know. I worked with him for some years. But he was no good at that job. If they'd moved John McComb up into my spot, well, we'd never know. But I think that might have been a better idea. But when CKNW decided that no longer cared to do that as its way of really making a living, and it lost its sense of community, the community lost gloriously. You're still a young man, Joe, but you're old enough to remember when you'd have died laughing if somebody told you that QMFM and CBC would be ahead of CKNW in the ratings. Right. You know, you'd have thought that the world would come to an end. And there they are, and they seem quite content to do it. But as I say, that's their business. What's public business is we're no longer being properly informed. We're no longer getting the truth about what's going on. No longer, and this I think is more important, no longer getting the opportunity to seek out the truth ourselves, ask questions. We're just not there anymore.
I'm joined now by George Garrett, who worked with Rafe at CKNW. Mr. Garrett himself, a distinguished and longtime journalist, would often appear on the Rafe Mayer Show to discuss the issues of the day. Please welcome back to the Plante Online program, George Garrett. Mr. Garrett, good morning.
Good morning.
Did you cover Rafe when he was in government?
Not as much as some other events over the years. I got to know him better after the election and after he had actually left politics and when he decided to come into radio.
Mm-hmm.
That's when I really got to know Rafe and to work with him. In fact, he was always appreciative of the fact that I contributed to his show. His first on-air appearance on CKNW was between midnight and 2 a.m. NW hired him just to get him started. They wanted him, and they were hoping that he could be a replacement for Barry Clark for the afternoon show, which they knew that Barry was going to retire.
Mm-hmm.
And sure enough, that's where Rafe began to make his name.
Now, well, I remember reading in different things he's written over the years that when he was at CGOR after leaving Bill Bennett's cabinet, he remembered just how much he envied the infrastructure that CKNW had because of guys like you, which CGOR didn't have. And he was saying, especially during the Olson case, how you knew details of the case even before the police did.
Well, it wasn't quite true, but I did a lot of stories on the Olson murders of 11 children in the early 1980s. And I remember Rafe saying, in fact, he wrote in one of his books about how he felt so alone at CJOR. He didn't have that support that CKNW had, and he cited Bill Hughes with Roving Mike, Earl the Pearl, Earl Bradford, who
mm-hmm.
was doing kind of a gossipy thing just before the Roving Mike.
Yeah.
And, of course, the NW newsroom led by Warren Barker. And Rafe said he felt he had no support at all at CJOR when he was competing with that team at CKNW.
So when you began appearing with him regularly, what was he like to work with? Because you'd worked with people like Webster in the past, and you mentioned already this famed and fabled CKNW newsroom. On air,
yes.
What was he like?
He was good to work with. We got along very well. He always appreciated me coming on his show, except for one occasion when I made a negative comment about what I considered to be yellow journalism. It was when Gordon Wilson and Judy Tayabji were becoming romantically entwined,
mm-hmm.
and another reporter who shall remain nameless got hold of a personal diary. which I thought was something that should not have been used. So on the air, I said, that's yellow journalism. And about 2 minutes after I got off the air, Shirley Stalker, the executive producer, came in and she said, you're off the show. So that's fine. I work for Warren Barker. I don't work for Rafe Mayer. But it wasn't long before I was back on. And one of the events I remember so vividly is the 1986 convention of the Socreds in Whistler.
Right.
Many say it was the best political convention ever in D.C., and it was exciting.
Yeah, and I remember him, you asked him for a blurb for your upcoming memoir about a year or so ago, and he cited that as a memorable moment for him as well.
It sure was. It's the incident that really remembers, both of us remembered well, was that Bill Vanderzam was one of the competitors, and Grace McCarthy was expected to win. But the key was that a supporter who had his own campaign, Bud Smith, who had always been pretty friendly to Rafe and so on, he decided to take his delegates and to go for Vanderzam. And I could see the movement, so I called to the producer and I said, put me on, because Bud Smith going to Vanderzam. And she relayed that to Rafe, and he said on the air, what? He said, that's impossible. That'll never happen in a million years. So he put me on, and I described it happening, and he never forgot that. And it was the tipping point. It meant that Vanderzam won the leadership and, of course, became the premier.
And didn't he say at the end of the convention that Vanderzam would destroy that party within a couple of years?
He did. Yeah. It took about 4 or 5 years,
but yeah.
That's what happened. And I remember doing stories about the disintegration of the Social Credit Party, and it was just something beholding to see. But it was a reflection, I think, of all the bad things that happened during the Vanderzam time. But on the positive side, as a reporter, it was a dream come true. There was a story almost every day.
Yeah.
And I was on Rafe's show because of that so many times. And we got along very well.
Yeah, he had great political sense, didn't he? And that just not only came from his experience in Victoria as an MLA and a cabinet minister, but his time as a lawyer as well, and he really had a passion for politics and the wider issues, especially in later years, the environment especially.
Yeah, he did. He was passionate about the Kamano Completion Project, you know, which would have changed the course of the river and would have destroyed fish stocks, in his opinion. Fought very hard with that, and actually won, although there were some court cases over it that he didn't win. And he was passionate about the environment generally. He was a trout fisherman. He loved stream fishing. He loved this province like no one I've ever known. And he loved Canada. And he fought very, very hard for constitutional matters. He was against the Meech Lake Accord, which was supposed to assuage Quebec after the very narrow referendum in 82, mm-hmm. in which Quebec almost left the country. And in Rafe's opinion, the Meech Lake Accord was granting too much to Quebec. He opposed it vehemently, and he had support all over the province. I remember going around the province to gauge the support or lack of for Meech Lake, and I found that Rafe had the pulse of the province. He really grasped what people were thinking. And, of course, the Meech Lake Accord failed, but later on the Charlottetown Accord did succeed, despite his opposition.
Yeah, and you're describing this time, the late 80s to the early to mid 90s, just a tumultuous time in British Columbia politics and Canadian politics.
It was for both.
Yeah.
He was passionate about both.
Yeah, and the station, this was pretty much the glory days of his time there, wasn't it?
It certainly was. He had a terrific audience, and it's a very, very competitive field. And I got an email from Ted Smith, manager of the day.
Mm-hmm.
He wrote to me since Rafe died, and he said he told Rafe Mayer that he had all kinds of talk show people. He really didn't need him, but if he would like to take the midnight to 2 a.m. Program, he could have it. And he said Rafe went to the bathroom to think about it, then came back and said, I'll take it.
Yeah.
Well, it was a very good decision on his part because it resulted in good ratings for CKNW and a tremendous career for Rafe Mayer.
Now, you'd seen him in recent years, had you? And he'd come on this show. Physically, he was in decline, but mentally and in his writing especially, his voice was still there, wasn't it?
That's right. The last time I saw Rafe was in Lionsgate Hospital. I had heard he was there, and I did not get a return call from his answering machine, although I'd called two or three times. So I thought, I'm going to go find him. So I drove to Lionsgate Hospital, and at the reception desk, I said, do you have a patient by the name of Rafe Mayer? The lady looked at me, and she said, oh, yes, we do. He was well known.
Yeah.
So I went to speak to him, and he had another visitor at the time, and he regaled me with stories about his treatment in the hospital. He said, I went on a hunger strike. I hated the food here, and I didn't like what my doctor was doing, so I checked myself out. He'd been in there because of a fall at home.
Mm.
He had some problems with balance and so on, and he walked with a cane later. So he was certainly not very strong physically. So he'd had the fall at home, went to the hospital, checked himself out, fell again, and then he was in the hospital for, I think, a couple of months. And I guess he learned his lesson. He had to stay there.
Mm. Yeah, but we've lost Georgia, a significant voice in this province and this country. But if anything else, he'll be remembered because he gave you the moniker, Intrepid Reporter, right?
Yes, he did. I had to go look in the dictionary. You know, I'm a high school dropout, essentially. So I had to go and look up what intrepid meant. And one of the descriptions was something like bold or courageous. And I thought you could also add rather naive. You know, I got beat up in Los Angeles because I was quite naive, believing that, oh, nobody would hurt an old reporter. I was in my 50s then.
Yeah.
But but I do appreciate what Rafe did for me. In fact, I hope to have a book published in the spring to be called The Intrepid Reporter. And in that book, I do pay tribute to Rafe for all that he has meant to British Columbia and to Canada.
Well, we'll wait for that to be published soon. George, I appreciate your time today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Another former colleague of both Rafe and George, Gary Bannerman, whom Rafe succeeded in the morning talk show slot on CKNW in 1988, was a guest on this program in its early years. Like Rafe, Gary was generous with his time and encouragement for my work. When Gary died in 2011, Rafe joined me on a tribute show that included for guests, among others, Shirley Stalker and former Premier Bill VanderZem. As you'll hear, Rafe didn't know what Gary had said about him.
He had high regard for your work. He said he loved listening to you because you were he called you the real McCoy when it came to being a passionate open-line host. You got to know him as well afterwards? Because he also talked about you guys having lunch from time to time.
Oh, yes, we did. And yeah. We did get to know each other much better afterwards. And that's the time you would with any of your colleagues. I'm very flattered that Gary would say the things he did. But, you know, I'll tell you very quickly what Jack Webster said to me when I was about to go on the air, and he was responsible for it. And he said, man, there are three things to remember, you dumb bugger. First of all, if you're interviewing your mother, write Mom on the piece of paper because you'll forget her name. Number two, don't try to be like Burns and be yourself. Number three, from now on, we're enemies. And that essentially said it all. I never blamed Jack for that at all. I was very wise. Stomp on the fingers of the guy below you. And after Jack left, we did an awful lot of work together, thanks to him. But that's sort of the attitude in the business. So you don't really have a chance to get somebody else, get to know somebody else very well. Your rivals, you don't much like them simply because they're doing something that you want to do yourself. And so when Gary left and I took his show, and we would meet afterwards. It was a great experience. We had dinner a couple of times and certainly had lunches and got involved in a number of activities that interested both of us. And as I say, he was a first-rate guy, and we're going to miss him.
I tweeted not too long ago that I thought if they did a Mount Rushmore of open-line hosts in Vancouver and British Columbia, they would have Jack Webster, Pat Burns, Gary Bannerman, and Rafe Mayer. I'm heartened to know that a lot of people online seem to agree. In 2004, Rafe published his memoir. He had just been fired from CKNW, but I noted that the chapter on it was quite sparse on details.
Well, I signed a release in order to get the money, which said that I couldn't talk about the reasons that led up to the dismissal. I can tell you this, that those reasons were part of a press release that I released 2 days before the end came, and they're available. And I think I would probably be breaking my agreement if I were to make it public again, but it's out there. It has been out there. The other thing was really, Joseph, while I think I was very, very badly done by CKNW, I think it was a horrid thing to do to somebody who had spent so much time there. In fact, I was very relieved because the last year or so had been really a torment for both my wife, Wendy, and me. And B, I just did not want to leave on a bad note. I wouldn't have minded having a shouting match with the manager, but that would mean I'd get into a shouting match with all the people that were still there, and they were all friends of mine, and I just didn't want that. I wanted to go into my new career on the high side, and I think I did. But that was basically the reason. First of all, as I say, I simply couldn't have done so without losing the money that I got for my departure. I suppose that's a little cowardly. I suppose I should have just said, to hell with you, I'm going to say it, and I'll sue you. But, you know, if you get to my stage in life and you look at a year's income, which was at stake, and you say to yourself, I'm not going to get that because I'm going to be high and mighty and sue these bastards, and it's going to be 3 or 4 years before it comes to a conclusion, I'm going to be in my deathbed by that time, I think it's pretty easy to understand why I just said, all right, I'll take the money and run.
Do you miss CKNW at all? Or?
I miss the old CKNW, Joe, when the Whig people were there, when Frank Griffiths was still alive, and you knew that absolute free speech would be the hallmark of the station as long as he or his influence was still there. I miss that part. I sure as hell don't miss the part which happened after Corus took over. Corus actually took over legally a year or two before they became, to me, a pain in the ass. But in the last couple of years I was there, last year and a half, 2 years, it was almost unbearable. And the mood of the place was so bad. The morale of the place had gone. It just was no fun. But if you could take me back to 1992, 3, 4, 5, or even before that, I loved it. And that part I miss.
From 2008, I asked Rafe about whether he thinks about death.
Oh, sure. Sure, lots of the time. And you know, it's like Woody Allen said, you know, I'm not scared of dying. I just don't want to be there when it happens. And this is sort of the way you get. And I'll tell you and what it does also, Joseph. It makes time much more precious. You find yourself actually doing things where other times you would have just sat in the corner and sucked your thumb. You really get out and try to get things done on a basis. But, you know, you just don't have much time to go. Well, that's one of the reasons I'm so passionately involved in Save Our Rivers. I'm in the last decade of my life, and I've got to do something while I've still got time.
Rafe had done a television program with a number of folks at a local station here in Vancouver that was broadcast across the country, if not elsewhere. One of the people he did that with was the journalist Craig McCullough. Sometime after that, Rafe wrote a book on thinking about faith, life, and death called The Homestretch. It's a very insightful book, here now from 2011.
So the title of this new book, The Home Stretch, suggests that you're in the home stretch of your own life now. I mean, you're 80. Is that how you feel? Is that how you look at life today?
Well, you know, I thought about a title for it, and I thought, you know, the home stretch, if you go to the races, is really probably, it's a pretty long stretch. Yeah, you know, you're by no means out of it yet, but you can see the finish line. And I think that's how I feel. I'm not over yet. I'm still as active as I've ever been. But I'd be fooling myself if I didn't say, well, you know, Rafe, in all likelihood, you're in the last decade of your life giving yourself the best of it. So it wasn't a gloomy title, Joe. It was just one that seemed to reflect where I was sitting right now. I was, you know, coming around the far turn, heading for home, and there were all the people there, and, you know, so on and so forth. And I felt that was probably the right title for it, for the way I felt.
But you set out in this book to ask questions about your life and what happens afterwards. Is that what happens afterwards? Is that something that people should be thinking about, do you think?
I think it's something that everybody does think about, even if they don't admit it. I think when you get to be about 8 or 9 or 10 and one of your grandparents dies, it's the first time you confront the fact that you're going to have to die yourself. You go as quickly as you can into denial after your mother pats you on the head. But I think for the rest of your life, you wonder, you know, I wonder what it's like. What should I be doing? Should I be doing anything? Is religion the way to go? And if so, what religion? And that sort of thing. And I honestly can say this, Joe. People say they don't do that. I don't think you're telling the truth. I think that's just a very human thing. You know you're here for a good time, not a long time. And you have to wonder whether there's anything on afterwards. and if so, what it is.
And so what are you looking for?
Well, I think I'm still, I'm looking for answers in the sense of is there a heaven and, or is there an afterlife and what is that like? But I've answered the question that troubled me the most, and that was, you know, what sort of religion should I come at this with, or any religion at all? And I grew up an Anglican, which is about as easy as it gets for a Protestant religion, as you know, or a pretty free and easy group. And I'd always puzzled over a number of things, and I thought to myself, why do I have to learn all this stuff, this catechism and so on? Why does it matter? And when I did the research for this book, I got to the famous passages, I think they're Mark and Luke, where Jesus is trying to outwit the, or the lawyer, should say, trying to outwit Jesus by saying, what laws do I obey? And Jesus said, thou shalt love the Lord thy God, etc. Thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself, and thou shalt neighbor as thyself. Really three things, because you must love your neighbor, love God, and you must love yourself. But everybody misses the next line, which is, he says, upon this commandment, hang all the law and the prophets. Well, that, I said, think about that, and that Jesus wasn't one for wasting words. But, well, now, what the hell does that mean? And it meant to me that if you agree with these three commandments, you do your very best to live up to them, that's all you can do. And that other stuff, forgiveness if it's going to offend anybody, but it's mumbo-jumbo. Whether Jesus was God or he ascended into heaven, why he wanted a body in heaven, I don't know, or any of these other things, is absolutely extraneous. And if you can concentrate on the things that Jesus said, and try your best to see to me that that's what the obligation was. And there was one other point on that, Joe. I don't think Jesus was talking to the scribes and the Pharisees and the educated folk in Israel at that time. He was talking to very ordinary people, and he was giving them things that they could understand. Now, I don't think that Jesus was saying to that group, if you don't believe that I walked on water, or if you don't believe that I ascend bodily into heaven, or if you don't believe that I'm God, etc., you're out of here. I don't think that was what he was saying at all. He was saying, look, here are the simple articles of faith. Follow them as best you can, and I'll forgive you when you go wrong, but that's what your obligations are. So that's what I finally came away from the whole exercise with, Joe.
So when you think about what heaven looks like or what heaven is, you obviously did some research of these various religions and what they consider heaven to be. What do you think it is?
Well, you know, that's a very good question. I didn't come away at all satisfied with that. I believe there is a life there hereafter. When I say life, I don't mean necessarily we're all going to be up in clouds plucking harps, but there's something that happens afterwards. I'm not quite sure what it was, and I did quite an examination of the spirit world, and remarkably, a lot of the writers that talk about that do say there is a spirit world, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, but they don't define it as exactly what it is. So I'm as much in the dark on that as I ever was. I'm much less in the dark on hell, however. Anybody who reads Revelation will know it's about the scariest book ever written, and that will give you all you need to know and more about hell.
Yeah, and so do you believe in, how credible is the idea that we come back as, say, ghosts or spirits?
Well, I think that we certainly are going to be something after death. The atheist would tell you that, you know, it's just you're gone, and that's the end of it, no matter what you say, but I don't believe that. I've talked to too many doctors and nurses and priests who have been in rooms where people have died and have actually felt something happen. There's so much of the after-death, not after-death, of course, not real death, but you know what I mean, when a person apparently dies and they go and see the white light and all the rest of it. There's so much of those experiences that I believe thoroughly that there is some kind of existence. Just what it is, I haven't yet found out.
How religious are you, Rafe?
Well, Michael, how you'd answer that. I certainly, as I get older, I feel a greater concern about the afterlife, but in other ways, I feel a sense of peace. And I think in a way, Joe, this may be just self-hypnosis. I would agree on that if anybody said that to me. But I think that since I have found those statements by Jesus about loving God, the neighbor, etc., I have felt much more at peace and much more confident that if there is anything after death, that I'm going to be there on the good side of it because I have tried to do those things. And I used to worry, Rafe, if you don't believe in the bodily ascension of Jesus, you don't believe, I'm going to be in a lot of trouble. I no longer feel that. I now feel that even if it's true, and an all-powerful God can make anything happen. But even if it's true, I don't think it's necessary. I think Jesus is telling us that's not necessary. He just simply has to follow these simple rules, which are not easy to follow. But you keep your attention on those and don't worry about other stuff.
Like Rafe, I am a collector of books. A friend of both Rafe and mine once called my collection aggressive. Rafe had written a lot about his love of buying and collecting books in recent years. He'd also write of having to give some of them up.
I love when you write about books, because I know you love books so much. And it broke my heart to read that in the last year or two you had to get rid of some of your books. Is that right?
It was like I've said to my so many friends, it was like giving away Labrador puppies one by one. It's just an awful feeling. I'm sitting looking now at probably a couple hundred books around me in my room downstairs, which I now have because I'm not doing well. But I gave away another 600 or 700 books, I guess.
Really?
And each one of them was like parting with an old friend. You know, I'd take the book and I'd look at it and say, God Almighty, I remember getting that book.
Yeah.
I went out to get this and I got that. You know, and they all became old friends, and it was an awful thing to have happen.
Yeah.
But mind you, you know, the books are something which are having trouble anyway, and there's not much you can do about that. You can't stop the modern world. But for me, an old man, I'll tell you, the feel of a book is something that will never be replaced by the Internet or Kindle or anything
yeah.
of that sort.
But you read on your iPad, don't you?
I do. I've started to do that, Joe. It happened rather strangely. Wendy and I were going on a holiday a couple of years ago, I guess, and we went to get on the plane, and they charged us $500-some-odd for the books we were taking for the cruise. And I said, geez, we'd be better off to toss them all on the floor and buy them again when we got back. But we didn't do that. And I said to Wendy, that will never happen again. I vowed I would never get a Kindle or an electronic book. I'd never, ever do that. It would just be, you know, it would be just an awful thing to do. But I said, no, we have to surrender. And so I have a Kindle. As a matter of fact, I'm reading a book off it right now when you called, to tell you.
Yeah.
Rafe was an avowed Churchillian. Here's a clip on our mutual admiration of Winston Churchill.
You know, as I mentioned in the introduction, we've chatted a number of times over the years. One of the first things I remember asking you, and I think it was an essay in one of your collections, was about Churchill.
Yeah.
And you spent some time in the book talking about him. And people ask me why he's so worthy of adulation, and my answer is he just is. And so I'm wondering, as a Churchillian, what do you tell people who ask you why you've come to admire him so much?
Well, I think I start out by saying, look, he had warts like everybody did. And because he was a giant of a man, many of his warts were gigantic, too. There were things about Churchill that he did that didn't turn out all that well. But I think the thing that that really makes me admire Churchill more than any other, with the exception perhaps of Jesus or one issue like that, is that when it came down to the real problem, he was right. He was right on the main thing. He was really the only person of any consequence in the entire world that saw what Hitler was all about back in the 30s. People saw him as perhaps a bad man, a tyrant, another Kaiser Wilhelm or something like that. But Churchill said, no, this man is different. This man is truly evil. Not only did he see that and try to get his country to recognize it, which they didn't, he stood alone. There's no question. Joe, I was alive and well at that time, and I can remember sitting with my dad and tears streaming down his face and starting down mine, too, as we heard Churchill speak. And I've spoken to so many people my vintage that were in Great Britain at that time, and they just, you know, it just makes your flesh crawl when they talk about what that man did. And a lot of things were rather little things. I was looking at a book the other day. I've got one sitting where I eat. I pick up and read once in a while. There was a picture of Churchill in his three-piece suit, his gold watch chain, and his Homburg hat, walking down the streets of the East End of London right after the bombing, and people flocking out just to touch him, and he's crying his eyes out. This man was, you know, he was never going to pretend that he was something else by wearing overalls or anything.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, people recognized him for what he was. So he was a giant, and I just have no hesitation to say that. I can't think of very much about him that I haven't read. And I've read lots of stuff that I think, oh, my golly, he didn't do that, did he? But overall, just nobody can touch him.
And you know, one then wonders if a guy like him or if he himself could have done well in politics today, say.
I think it would have been pretty tough.
Yeah.
I really do. I mean, you can imagine a press conference in the morning, and first of all, he's not there because he doesn't go places in the early morning. He's reading his newspapers in bed. Well, those kind of habits are pretty difficult to reconcile to the day. And the first reporter says, well, Mr. Churchill, how many brandies did you have last night? And this sort of stuff. The same with Roosevelt. Roosevelt was very, very well treated by the press. They didn't ask him about his love affairs and so on and so forth. In this day and age, with the way the media is and the way we all are, I don't think that they would have the same kind of a chance. But, you know, you go back to Churchill's time. Edward VIII and his girlfriend, Wallace Simpson, mm-hmm. That affair was hushed up in Britain, and the newspapers all agreed not to print it. Can you imagine that happening today? You know, not a chance. So I think it was very, very different, and it's hard to know what he would have done. He was a very strong man, and you know, I think that he would have done well, but it would have been a hell of a lot more difficult, that's for sure. But you've got to remember, Joe, he went all the way through the war with active opposition in the House of Commons.
Yeah.
They had two confidence votes. He had a couple of people. Emanuel Shinwell was one, and Nye Bevan was another. Spent the whole war barracking him about how he was conducting it and about supplies, and they had all sorts of information. Gave him a hard time all during the war. So it wasn't as if he just had a free ride. It was tough, and he stood up to it, and, you know, I honestly think this is maybe a little dramatic, but I honestly think that if it hadn't been for Churchill, we'd all be speaking German.
Yeah, and let's not forget, too, right after the war, he loses the election.
Well, he did, that's interesting because he didn't really lose the election himself. The Conservative Party did. You've got to remember, they'd been in power since 1935. They probably would have been knocked out if they'd had an election between then and the war, but they didn't. So it was time for a change. But the second and overwhelming thing was that all these soldiers and sailors and airmen were overseas. There weren't houses, et cetera, and they were just not prepared to come back and sort of touch the forelock to the master of the acreage anymore. They were different. They'd seen war. They wanted a different life, and the people just didn't think that the Conservatives they knew could provide that. And I think the people were probably right.
Over the last couple of years, Rafe had been in ill health. It was tough for him to get around. I was talking to someone close to him in recent days, and though he'd suffered a setback or a fall, he would get better. Throughout it all, his writing and his voice remained strong. This from September 2014.
It hasn't been a pleasant year, I understand.
No, health-wise, it's been crappy, Joe, but... you know, I was just writing one of my daughters who wanted to know how I was feeling, and I said, well, the good news is nobody can find anything wrong with me. You know, I haven't got any lurking diseases, apparently, that are about to fail me, although I suppose we all have those. But it has been crap. It's been over a year now. I've been in and out of hospital. I was in hospital for 4.5 months from December through the end of April, and then I was just back in for another week last week, so it's been a little tough. Basically, I feel pretty good, except I'm very weak. I get up and I get dizzy and that kind of stuff. But maybe that's just old age.
But, yeah, you've been writing quite a bit recently, and the voice is still there.
Yeah, I've always, you know, luckily, I've always felt that I can still scribble a little bit, but that's about it. The other things that I like to do so much, the ones that require a little energy getting up and about, I'm afraid I can't, but... I have been writing a bit, and I always enjoyed writing. I don't think I'm any good at it, but I enjoy it, and maybe that comes through a little bit.
Rafe was born New Year's Eve, 1931. When he turned 80, Sherelle Tobin, among many others, put together a roast for him. It was a grand time with many great speakers. You can see clips of it online, as well as Rafe's own remarks, which are worth revisiting. I talked to him some weeks after the event in December 2011.
Well, it was very, it was extraordinary. I've done, you know, lots of public speaking in my time, and I've had people applaud and people boo. But I just felt, and this is going to sound awfully corny, Joe, but I'm going to say it anyway, I just felt a sense of love in the place. I really did.
Yeah.
And even when I used a four-letter word, it didn't seem to bother anybody. It was a glorious evening, and so many of the so-called roasters were so good, and it was just great.
Rafe's last appearance on this show was in early December 2015. Here's the end of that conversation.
You've got a birthday coming up.
I have a birthday coming up on the 31st of the month, New Year's Eve. I'll be 84, and there we are. I can't believe it. I can't believe it, because if you'd known me when I was 40, which you wouldn't have, I mean, you weren't born then, but if you'd known me when I was 40, you'd have said there's no chance this guy'll ever make 80. So, so there we are. I've done that.
Well, happy birthday in advance, and all the best for Happy Christmas to you and Wendy.
Well, and same to you, Joe, and it's always a pleasure to be on your show. Anytime you want, I followed your career for a pretty long time, too, and you're one of my heroes, so it works out very well.
Well, you know how I feel about you and how a lot of us feel about you. We just have come to admire you over the years and always wish you the best.
Well, thank you so much, Joe. As I say, anytime, just give me a holler.
Unfortunately, he never appeared again. We exchanged emails and tweets, though I did give him a holler a couple of times, once on a personal matter that involved him. It brought him great delight that something he had been involved with some years prior was still being discussed and a cause for consternation for others. I want to thank Sherelle Tobin and George Garrett again for taking the time this week to share their remembrances with me. Rafe Mayer dead at the age of 85. We shall never see his like again, and though some people in influence are glad of that, I'm so glad we had him for as long as we did. In Vancouver, I'm Joseph Plunter.